Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. With me in studio is my executive assistant, Morgan Murphy. Good morning, Morgan.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley.
You're a master's student at the University of Arizona. You're one of the great things that we celebrate is the outcomes of students. We talk about wonder at the University of Arizona, where we do celebrate the good things going on, including student projects, learning and outcomes, and we're going to celebrate your graduation in May when you complete your master's degree.
Yes.
We also celebrate top-level performances by artists and athletes. I was on campus this week with a great Arizona Arts Live presentation, and of course the basketball teams and the football team is going strong. The other 21, other 19 athletes or teams are doing their thing. But we especially like to look at top-tier research with faculty and scientists at the University of Arizona. We have one of those scientists, soon-to-be Dr. Battle, Adam Battle, who's a research lead at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley. Thank you for that introduction.
Well, thank you for being here. We're going to talk a little bit about satellites and your spectral fingerprint. But before that, what's your educational journey? You're finishing up your schooling at the U of A, but how did you get to the University of Arizona, and what's your academic path that you've taken so far?
Yeah, so I had a kind of unconventional path in the sense that I did undergraduate at the Ohio State University in physics and astronomy, graduated in 2015. After that, I did some time in industry where I learned a lot of the skills that I use today, studying satellites with telescopes, getting brightness measurements of those objects. And after about 4 years of doing that, I found a research lab that did both that as well as some study of asteroids, which kind of combined my two interests, and came here to do research in that lab with Dr. Eddy.
Great. And you're almost a doctor, right? You're working through your doctoral program. So how close are you?
I defended last week,
Well, congratulations.
1 week ago. Yeah,
so you know what? I'm just going to call you Dr. Battle, okay?
Because
if you made it through that process, that's a tough process to go through, but congratulations to
you.
It's like a big anvil off your shoulder, isn't it? It's a huge weight off your shoulder. Mm. Congratulations on your academic success. Well, you have an interesting little project that you're working, it's a big project that you're working on, which is basically doing a spectral fingerprint and looking up into the sky and seeing all of these man-made things that have been put up there over the last 70 years, and where are they, and what are they, and whose are they, and what do they look like, and what are they made of, and all that. So tell us a little bit about this project, the spectral fingerprint of satellites in space.
Yeah, so the spectral fingerprint project is basically trying to establish a baseline of what geostationary satellites look like, not only in brightness measurements, but also in spectroscopy. So we're taking just this dot of white light that you get in the telescope, and we're breaking it into its constituent colors so you can get more information out of the same amount of time of observing. And by doing that, we can start to see potentially what materials are on those objects, but more importantly, if we can see exactly how those colors change over time for a specific object, look at that at the different seasons, different nights. That's where we get that fingerprint and can uniquely identify different geostationary satellites.
That's interesting. Morgan, I'm going to put you on the spot. I want you to tell me what you think the number of artificial objects are in Earth orbit, as noted by the United States Space Surveillance Network, part of U.S. Space Command. How many things do you think are up there that man over the last 70 years
but
has
shouldn't it be up there?
put into the space? How many do you think it is?
Let's see. Probably thousands. I don't know. Yeah, thousands. I don't even want to know.
Well, the number's about, what is the number? It's about 45,000, right?
46,000. It's gone up since, you know, that was written even.
Yeah.
So it's always going up.
Right. Because we're continuing to put communication satellites into space, mostly surveillance satellites, all different kinds of satellites. Mm-hmm. But companies and governments are putting satellites up in space. And that's important because we need to know what's up there. And it's kind of like a freeway. Mm-hmm. And all these vehicles are up there. And you got to kind of know autonomously where they're driving or where they're orbiting. And that's important. And then we'll talk in a little bit about a geo-orbit. But 45,000 artificial objects in space is a tremendous amount of, I mean, that is a lot of, that's filling up, basically Arizona Stadium with people is about 50,000 people. It's a lot of things in space that are going in zooming by each other, right?
Yeah, yeah, it is a lot of things. They're not all operational either. A lot of that is just space junk, spent rocket bodies, you know, trash debris that doesn't really serve a purpose, but there's no one to really kind of bring them back down to Earth, recycle them or anything, take them out of orbit. So it just floats around up there.
How did you come up with the idea of using spectroscopy? Did I say that right?
Spectroscopy.
To accomplish this tracking. Why did you use and the light and the different seasons and so forth? How did that come about? How did you think that through as your team thought through? How would they make this fingerprint? How did you come up with that idea of being the way to do it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is Dr. Reddy's ideas, and he's my advisor, and he's a really great researcher. But the idea was that he has a lot of experience in studying asteroids, and I've learned a lot of that from him, and could combine that with my previous experience studying satellites, which he also does. And we're kind of using these decades-old research techniques that were used for asteroids and applying them to these new objects so that we can gain more information out of them. And it basically boils down to you're just seeing a dot of light. What more can we get out of that dot of light? And one of the ways to do that is make it more than just a dot, make it a spectrum.
Right. And so depending on what the color is, the time of the year, you know, it's tough to look at in Tucson just a couple nights a year. It's a little tough when the clouds are in the way during the monsoons and so forth. But most of the time it's good viewing weather in Tucson, right?
Yeah, Tucson definitely made this possible because we have a lot of clear weather during those monsoon months. Yeah, we couldn't observe, but we also have access to a student-built telescope that's here on the University of Arizona campus, and we're able to use that pretty much as much as I needed, and those two things together gave me all the time and capabilities to do a big study like this.
So the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory is studying, it's obviously very famous around astronomy and just mapping out the universe and so forth. The university has been involved in every NASA program since its inception. And so you're at a pretty good place to be able to be doing something like this, to have an institution that's really focused on astronomy and what's out there and what do we know and what can we know.
Yeah, yeah. LPL, the Lunar and Planetary Lab, is a really great institution, lots of history there, and really great professors to collaborate with and do good research.
I had the good fortune of Chris Impey, who's a astronomy instructor and astrophysicist and so forth, has spoke at the University of Arizona TEDx program at homecoming. Boy, just the mind-boggling stuff that you guys have discovered over the years. We're talking with soon-to-be Dr. Adam Battle from research lead at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona. We're talking about his new spectral fingerprint that he and his team are working on to kind of find out exactly what these satellites are, what's up there, and what we have to think about. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about his research at the University of Arizona and what's up in the sky. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. We're talking satellites this morning. We're talking with soon-to-be, or I could tell him he already is, in my mind he already is, Dr. Adam Battle, who is with the research lab of Lunar Planetary Laboratory. And with me in studio is my assistant, executive assistant, Morgan Murphy. Morgan, I have a question for you.
Okay, go for it.
What's geo-orbit? Geo-orbit, G-E-O, geo-orbit.
You know, not quite sure.
So what does orbit mean?
Orbit means to go around.
Okay.
And geo, I just think the world, maybe orbiting the planet.
Okay, That's right. You got it. You're close. She's pretty close. So you're halfway there. So Dr. Battle, explain to us what geo-orbit is.
Sure. Geostationary Earth orbiting satellites. So that's what the geo comes from. It's a very special orbit where essentially the satellite orbits the Earth at the same rate that the Earth rotates. And so for people on the ground, it looks like the satellite's not moving.
Right. It's always in the same position when you look up into the sky, no matter when you look up into it. From your perspective, it looks like that satellite is stationary, when in reality, it's traveling at a very fast rate of speed, and it just happens to be the same speed that the Earth is rotating. Right,
right. Yeah.
So to the naked eye, it looks like... I was out this early this morning at 2 o'clock this morning doing my time, and I looked up in the sky, And I thought, you know, these constellations have been here stationary, and they move across the sky, and they're stationary, but they're all really traveling really and very fast.
Yeah.
And but it looks to us from our perspective that that they're going slow or that they're not moving at all because that they're in this geo orbit. So now, Morgan, you know what geo orbit is. It's kind of an interesting thing. So 45,000 artificial objects, everything from satellites, communication satellites, and military satellites, and there's only so much room in geo orbit for these satellites to be in, and it's kind of like the bandwidth on, you know, this radio station is using part of the bandwidth to broadcast its signal. There's only so much space around a sphere or a globe as big as the Earth, and you know, no matter how you slice it and dice it, there's a limit to how many of these objects that can be in geo orbit. So how does that all work out? How do these satellites get to adopt that space and be there, and in order for us to track those things?
Yes, yeah. So it's a very special orbit. So it is kind of a coveted place in space, and this orbit's used for all types of things, like, you know, communications, satellite, internet,
GPS for our phones, those kind of things.
Augments GPS on your phone, monitoring fires and weather on Earth. So it is a very special coveted slot, and usually satellites get kind of an orbital slot that's a specific kind of parking spot to go based off of an international agreement.
Right.
And I think as time goes on, we're trying to squeeze more and more parking spots into those orbits, but at some point you can only do so much because it's a very, very specific altitude, very fine controlled kind of orbital station keeping that these satellites have to do to keep in that very specific spot.
And this is why your spectral and your fingerprint idea is so important, because you have to know, one, what's out there, and two, what it is and what orbit they're in. And so your fingerprint allows scientists to understand exactly what they're dealing with and how many parking spaces are available and how many of these craft can be out there at one time all in the same place. So let's just take an average, you know, I'm not so sure there's such a thing as an average satellite, but we shoot a satellite up into the sky and it gets into geo orbit. How long do they typically last? How long are these satellites kind of, what's their lifespan?
The typical lifespan is somewhere between 10, 15 years. So not terribly long. That's part of why we want to do this research. We want to see not only can we identify which objects they are, but also if something goes wrong on them, we want to be able to say, oh, I have spectra that show maybe this is a solar panel broke off. So we can tell information about that potentially. And they last about 15 years, which isn't terribly long. After they are kind of done with that, they use their last little bit of fuel to do a graveyard orbit shift. So they boost up just a little bit higher. They're out of that, you know, very precious geostationary belt in a graveyard orbit that's about 300 kilometers higher than that.
And so that's where they go to die. And how long, I mean, obviously they could, you could stay, well, we would, in our lifespan, we would stay for a long, 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 long time. But they go up there and they're continuing their orbit around the Earth, yet they're no longer functioning what they did. So they're really at some point could be considered space junk, right? At that point?
Yeah, after that point, they're essentially space junk. A lot of them, they're not doing these station keeping maneuvers to keep pointed down at the Earth with their communication array pointed at a station on the ground. So they'll start to tumble. They definitely start drifting. They're no longer in the same spot in the sky for observers. So they definitely are defunct after that point.
And so some of them could come back to Earth eventually, get out of their orbit, but not typical, but they could. But they could also, could they go out of orbit and be kicked off into space eternity forever? Or do they stay in that orbit pretty much for what we would consider eternity, because we're not going to be around to see it, but they stay in this belt for quite some time then?
Yeah, once they're in that kind of graveyard orbit, they'll be there for decades, centuries. Really pretty much nothing's going to kick them out of there. So there's just a band of trash kind of right outside the geobelt.
Right, unless something passed by the Earth really, 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 really close, their orbit would not be too much disrupted. And if something did come that close to the to the Earth, we wouldn't be worried about disrupting the trash belt. We'd be worrying about whether or not we're going to stay alive. So who else is on this research team that's looking at these the spectral fingerprint of these satellites? Who else is on your major players on your team?
Yeah, so not only am I, you know, a graduate student in the Lunar and Planetary Lab, but I'm also a member of the Space 4 Center. So it's a new center at the University of Arizona, Space Safety, Security, and Sustainability Center. And as I've mentioned, Dr. Vishnu Reddy is my advisor. He's also the director of that center, along with our co-director, Roberto Furfuro. And they're both a really great team. I also have some undergraduates that I work with. One in particular, Rebecca Lersch, is doing a really great kind of follow-up study on this type of research, where we're starting to get a basis of what all these objects look like, kind of a spectral baseline. But she wants to look at if we can see how the spectra for an object that's dominated, just covered in solar panels, which was kind of a method used in like the 70s and 80s, can we detect specifically that material, start doing the spectral unmixing where we can say specifically what materials are on a satellite based on these observations. So it's really cool follow-up work.
Really interesting, yeah. And so not all of these satellites can be seen from Tucson because we're at a vantage point where we can see a lot of them, but not 100% of them. So you have some team members in the other side of the hemisphere, in the southern hemisphere, that are, or other side of the world, that are looking at them from a different perspective, right?
Yes, yeah. As great as geostationary objects are for easy observations, they don't move, so we can only see that limited chunk of the geo belt. And so we are, we've created a new observatory that's kind of as close to a twin of our current system as we can. It's located in central Australia, and actually my fellow graduate student David Cantillo is remotely observing from Australia. So he gets to do graduate studies here, observe from Australia, and he'll see a new chunk of the geo belt, which has all new players, different satellites from different manufacturers, hopefully new materials to really expand that baseline of spectra of satellites.
Well, let's go visit him in Australia. That sounds like a fun place to go. So we're talking with soon-to-be Dr. Adam Battle, research lead at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. What's the next step in the research? So, you know, if you've got this fingerprint and you're mapping all of these objects, 45,000 plus objects in space, what's the next step in the research once you get this fingerprint put together?
Yeah, so this is kind of a starting point for using spectroscopy on these objects. We've looked at about 96 unique ones, which even that took 200 nights. So we're not mapping all 45,000, right, thankfully. But with this baseline of spectra that we have, kind of they're a perfect data input for machine learning algorithms. So you get these nice kind of 3D maps of what the spectra look like under different illumination conditions, and that image can be fed into machine learning algorithms that we're developing so that we can uniquely identify, do that fingerprinting, uniquely identify satellites, see when spectral changes occur, which part of the satellite that might be coming from, see which features are important, and a whole bunch of new techniques that
and
we'll
develop. With the AI and this technology, it'll speed up then the process. It's not 100% just you guys doing it manually, if you will. It'll speed up that process, and a lot more of these vehicles and space junk will be fingerprinted. What are your plans? What are you going to do with your degree when you become a doctor here pretty quickly?
Yeah, so I'll be graduating here in December, which is really exciting. Mm-hmm. And then I am sticking around for a while to do a postdoc with Vishnu Reddy and Roberto Furfuro here at the Space Force Center and at LPL. So I'll be continuing sort of this type of work, helping the students that I mentioned earlier for kind of getting their work going into a point where they can also hopefully publish papers on those, as well as continuing some asteroid research that recently got funded.
Fascinating, fascinating career that you're headed into, and an interesting orbit that you're in. Pun, that was a little bit.
Yeah, I got that.
Yeah, a little bit of a pun. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Adam Battle, soon to be Dr. Adam Battle, here in December, research lead at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona, talking about a fingerprint, if you will, a spectral fingerprint of satellites in the sky. So thank you so much for being with us this morning. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI, 1030 AM, The Voice, Tucson's only live local talk. We'll come back after the break and talk a little bit more about some fascinating things happening out in the world, in the universe, and stars. And so we'll come back. Thank you, Dr. Battle, for being here with us this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Great, and have a very celebrated holiday becoming a new doctor at the University of Arizona.
Thank you.
You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. With me in studio is Morgan Murphy, my executive assistant. Good morning, Morgan.
Good morning.
I didn't demote you from CEO to executive assistant, but I thought I'd start using your appropriate title. So
that's fair.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And thanks for setting up our guest again today. This is kind of astronomy day on Jump in Tucson on the Monday Wonder series. We talked a little bit about satellites in the sky and how we track those and what's in what parking spot in geo orbit. And in this segment, we're going to talk with Andras Gaspar. He is associate research professor at Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you have a fascinating, some research that you're doing, but before we get to that, let's ask you a little bit about your educational journey and how you got to the University of Arizona.
Oh, well, that starts way back when I was a young boy. The listeners may be able to identify that I have a little bit of an accent, so I actually wasn't born here. I was born and raised in Hungary, so I grew up there, and I was already really interested in physics at a young age and went to astronomy camps and so on. And that led me to be even more interested in astronomy, and I got an undergraduate degree in astronomy in Hungary, and from there on, I got into graduate school here at the University of Arizona in 2006.
I want you to say a sentence in Hungarian. Just say something. Happy Thanksgiving to you all in Hungarian. I'd just be interesting to hear how you say it. Just say something in Hungarian.
Boldog hálaadás mindenkinek.
Very cool. Very cool. you have a great English command of the English language as well. Well, what's your responsibility at the U of A? You're associate research professor at the Stewart Observatory, but what does that mean? What are you doing at the U of A?
So, as I said, I've been here since 2006, so I've gone through the entire range from graduate student to postdoc through assistant to now associate astronomer. And my primary
responsibility
is that I'm a member of the JWST science instrument teams. We have two instrument teams here at the University of Arizona. One of them is the NIRCam instrument team, and the other one is the mid-infrared instrument science team. These are two detectors on the James Webb Space Telescope, and the near-infrared camera, the main detector on the Space Observatory, is actually LED here at the Stewart Observatory, so the principal investigator on that is Marsha Rieke, and the U.S. science team lead for the mid-infrared instrument is George Rieke, and I've been working with them since 2006, and as a member of the science instrument teams, we helped actually test the instruments and then commission them after launch.
Right. So Tucson's been known over the last 100 years as a great place for observing stars from land-based telescopes, not only at the Stewart Observatory and up on Mount Lemmon and Mount Bigelow and Mount Graham and Kitt Peak and all the other places that we have telescopes around here and the beautiful skies that we have. But a real game changer for astronomy was when the Hubble Space Telescope was launched several years ago, and now most recently the James Webb Telescope. These are amazing instruments that are out there, and the resolution that they're, the distance that they're looking is just amazing, isn't it?
That's right, and so the University of Arizona is leader in ground-based observing, as you've said, but we've also been leaders in space-based observing. So one of the instruments on the Hubble Space Telescope, which is not working now, NICMOS, was actually built here at the University of Arizona. And you didn't mention the Spitzer Space Telescope, which was one of our other very large projects. The MIPS instrument on Spitzer was built here at the University of Arizona, and the principal investigator of that instrument was George Rieke, my current boss.
That's fantastic. So right now, these you've been able to tap into these telescopes and do an in-depth look at a nearly, this blew me away when you told me this, 100 billion mile diameter debris disk encircling Vega.
Yeah.
That's huge.
It's a pretty big disk. And Vega is a very famous star. So if you look up at a night sky, especially in the summertime when it's really visible, you can see Vega. It's the brightest star you'll see in the summer night sky. So if you look up, there's a very bright star. It's going to be Vega, probably the one you're looking at. And it's very close to us, and it's a very luminous, hot star. And because of that, it's been a star that astronomers have used for a very long time as a standard star. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it's not really a good source to use as a standard because it's got this whopping big disk around it.
Right. And it is bright for, like you said, for two reasons. It's closer.
That's right.
Than most other stars. And it is just an luminous, it illuminates a lot of energy. And
that's
so
right.
That's a bright star to begin
that's
with.
That's right.
But it's also closer. That's why it's so bright in the
sky.
Yeah.
So it's an A-type star, and it's about 40 times more luminous than our sun.
Which is pretty bright.
It's
yeah.
pretty bright.
Yeah. And so how far is 100 billion miles? I mean, that's just mind-boggling to even think about that.
It is. So put it in terms, the disk's peak is at about 100 astronomical units away from us, mm-hmm. which is one astronomical unit is the average distance between the sun and the earth. Mm-hmm. So it's quite large. Yeah.
Right. So it's an amazing, I just fascinated by the distances that we're dealing with in the universe and so forth. So this, what is this dust debris that's circling Vega? What is it made of?
So let's go back a little bit in history because it's actually really interesting. So as I said, Vega is a standard star, has been for a long time. And because of this, it was used as a calibrator source for the very first infrared space observatory, the IRIS Space Observatory, which went up in 1983.
Right.
And they looked at Vega as one of the six calibrator sources they wanted to use to get their brightness system calibrated. And it turned out that something funky was going on with this star. It was way brighter in the infrared wavelengths than it should have been, just based on if it was a pure star. So that was when this very first debris disk was found, by happenstance of using the star as a calibrator source. And right after that, that observatory actually found a few dozen other similar systems. But to answer your question, what is this? Well, these are leftover planetesimals, basically, that still orbit the star, that are left over from the period of planetary system formation. But this is an old star. It's a mature star. It's about 400 million years old, which is actually quite old for a very luminous star that mm-hmm. Vega is.
And so the stuff that's in the disk is this planetary dust and mm-hmm. and debris that's left over from, didn't form into star, into planets.
That's right.
It just still resting there. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what we see a little bit around Saturn and similar, but not exactly the same.
Sort of. The better analogy is the asteroid belt and the Kuiper belt around the sun.
Gotcha.
And that's exactly what we're seeing, except our sun is old, so our Kuiper and asteroid belts have been able to grind themselves down. And what we actually see around all of these systems is the tiniest dust particles that are produced through these collisions of the small planetesimals that are left over.
That's great. And so we call this a ring of dust.
That's
and,
right.
So the infrared Spitzer Space Telescope then mapped out this ring, and other telescopes also looked at it and so forth. What makes looking at this information different from other rings of dust that we're seeing? What are you seeing that's different from other things that are similar?
So you need to understand first the difference between Spitzer and JWST. Yeah. A lot of people, so JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope, is the big new thing, right?
Right.
And people like to call it the successor of Hubble, but in reality, it's the successor of Spitzer mm-hmm. because they are the ones that are observing the same wavelength range. The uh-huh. Hubble Space Telescope observes at visible wavelength range, so the wavelength ranges that we see with our own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Spitzer and JWST observes at much longer wavelengths where bodies are able to actually emit from their own thermal emission. So mm-hmm. JWST would be able to see you and I as we're standing here glowing.
Mm-hmm.
Hubble observes in scatter light. So the Hubble Space Telescope observed the tiniest dust particles as they're scattering light off their surfaces. So imagine someone puffing a cigarette and you see the smoke, and the smoke scattering the sun's light off of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Hubble's able to see. With JWST, we actually see them glowing from their own temperature, basically.
Wow.
So you're seeing slightly larger particles and different characteristics of the particles. So Hubble was fantastic, and it still is fantastic, at observing the scatter light of the smallest dust particles. Spitzer came along and was really good at observing the glow of these dust particles, but Spitzer was smaller. Mm-hmm. Spitzer's diameter is about 1 meter, 80 centimeters to be exact. JWST's diameter is 6.8 meters. So it's almost 10 times as big,
right.
Which means its resolution is about 10 times better.
Fascinating. When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit more about the detail we see from the James Webb Telescope and the Spitzer Telescope understand the distances that we're dealing with here, which are amazing and always fascinating. We'll come back and we'll talk with Andras Gaspar, Associate Research Professor at the Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona. Astronomy Day at the Jump in Tucson on the Wonder Series for Jump in Tucson. We'll be back after the break. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. The sky is full of stars, and this is kind of the astronomy hour on Jump in Tucson on this Monday. We're talking about WONDER, the great research and information going on that's telling us lots of stuff about who we are, where we are in the universe. And we're speaking, just want to say welcome back again to Morgan Murphy, my executive
assistant.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. And our guest is Andras Gaspar. He is Associate Research Professor at the Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona. So you had mentioned before the break that we have just seen some incredible detail from both Spitzer, but also from the James Webb Telescope. It's amazing the detail that you're able to see. It's kind of like you said, the analogy of smoke rising from a cigar or cigarette, and being able to see that and see what's reflecting off of that, and seeing the these bodies emit this this energy that you can see. It's pretty fascinating. Who would have known, 200 years ago that we'd have this telescope in space that can show us some things that is a kind of the definition of why are we here and what's out there?
Yeah, JWST has really increased our perspective on our world, absolutely.
Yeah. So, again, I go back to these distances that we're talking about. We're talking about this star being 10 astronomical units away from Earth, right?
Did you say? No, the star's the about, star. The star itself is about 40 light years from us.
40 light years, okay.
But the disk around it is about 100 astronomical units.
So that's right. Pretty amazing, isn't it, those distances? That's a huge, huge, huge area.
It is, and the interesting thing is now we can actually compare these to how our solar system looks like, right? That's the main point of all of this research, is to understand our own world in context of what we're seeing out there, how easy it is to form planetary systems, and how our solar system compares to others. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep in mind, as we said, Vega is extremely luminous. Mm-hmm. And that means you have to upscale everything. So what the outer belt here that we see can be analogous to the Kuiper belt around our solar system. That's much closer. That's about 40 astronomical units away. And so all of that scales up because of the large temperature and brightness, luminosity of Vega.
Could there be, obviously there are other researchers are looking at this probably, but could there be planetary systems that are closer into Vega that we can't see because it's so bright and we can't see them? And, they obviously the planetary thing has to move in front of the star from our point of view or from Webb's point of view or whatever. Do we know if there's exoplanets out there circling around Vega? We don't, maybe not.
So Vega has one potential possible exoplanet around it, but it's not certain. And the interesting part of the JWST observations of this particular system is that the disk seems to be extremely smooth, and spread out without any structure in it. And you ask what differentiates these observations from the previous ones? Well, this is what differentiates it. With this increased resolution, we're able to try to find structures in the system, but we don't see any, which hints at the fact that this system does not have any massive planets in it. So it's different from the solar system, right? The solar system has the four main gas giants that are massive in the outer regions. Mm-hmm. It seems Vega doesn't have any of that.
Right. And so this dust might be the things that could have been made into planets, but they didn't get made into planets, and they're just smooth out there.
Sort of like that, yeah. So the outer regions has these planetesimals that are continuously colliding, producing the smallest dust particles that we can see. And what we think is happening is, since there are no planets to really interfere with them,
and what you called in the article snow plowing their way through the dust, right?
So they're slowly migrating inwards, and then meeting with the star and sublimating, but it results in this very homogeneous, even smooth disk surface.
But this moving towards the planet takes millions of years, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Long time.
Long
time. At least from out here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, especially from those distances into the star.
Exactly.
And who knows how long the star will be around. I guess they
can... Not a long time. Yeah. So Vega, since it's a very luminous star, it's going to end its life in a few hundred million years.
It's churning through its fuel is what it's doing, right? So its life, because it's so bright, its lifespan will be
exactly
shorter than what a normal...
Did you take an astronomy course at the U of A?
I'm just fascinated by the distances and what is happening out there. It's amazing. So there's still a lot of unknowns in planet formation, and these observations are helping us to kind of understand, which is maybe one of the major focuses of foci of astronomy, is how do we get here? And how did our Earth get here? And how did we get formed? And why are we here? This is kind of helping us answer those questions.
Absolutely. So exoplanet research has been booming, right? We found the very first exoplanet in 1995. And since then, we've found over 5,000 exoplanets around other stars, which is amazing. But most of them are not similar to what we're accustomed to seeing around our sun. Why? Well, because there are probably selection effects. We're much more easily able to detect very massive planets orbiting very close to their stars with our current indirect methods of observing exoplanets.
So when you were a little kid getting interested in astronomy, did you ever think you'd be working on the James Webb telescope and looking out into the star Vega, the brightest star that you saw from your backyard? Amazing.
No, but JWST wasn't planned. Really. Right. The first plans,
They did it for you.
That's right. The first plans came out in 2000, I think, for JWST. Right. So it was a long project.
So what's your future in astronomy? You're working on this project now, but what are you hoping to do in your research in the coming years?
We hope to study these and other systems in even more greater detail using JWST.
And is there another version of the James Webb telescope in the next 30 years? Will there be another one that goes out that they're working on now?
Well, the big one that's under consideration right now is the Habitable Worlds Observatory, which is directly aimed at looking at a few dozen sources where they're trying to find habitable worlds. So
right.
Planets that are similar in size and shape to Earth.
In that habitable zone behind by their stars, yeah. To get there, and if we need to move someday.
We wouldn't be able to do that.
it would take a wormhole in the fabric of space in order to get us there, right?
Yeah, but it would be comforting to know, right?
Yeah, it would be comforting to know. Yeah. Well, this is fascinating research that you have, and thank you for sharing with us this morning. We hope that you stick around the University of Arizona and stay here and continue to do the great research that you and your team are doing on Vega and other things out in the universe. It's just fascinating. It's the most fascinating thing I can think of. So,
well, thank you for saying that and for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Coming up on Tuesday, Ted Maxwell hosts the Engagement Hour on Tuesday. He does that, and he engages with civic leaders and so forth. It's a great program. Grant Kruger will be here on Wednesday with his take on food for thought. He talks about restaurants and civic engagement from that perspective. Tom Moulton is here on Thursday, thanks to our good friends at Visit Tucson. We thank Felipe and Graham for supporting us here. And Tom talks about the attractions that the people come from all over the world to see. Those 7 million people are coming here for a reason. And part of it is to see the stuff down at the U of A and the astronomy that's going on there. And I'll be back on Friday with some success stories about organizations and businesses that are doing well. And then the following Monday, we'll be back with our friends from the University of Arizona with the Wonder Series. If you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson and share your success story, go to jumpintucson.com. Let us know a little bit about you, and who knows, maybe you'll be live on the air. You have a great, fantastic week, Morgan. So thank you for being here this morning.
Of course.
You do great work. We appreciate you scheduling our guests this morning. And Dr. Gaspar, we just want to thank you for your good work at the University of Arizona. And thank you for being here on Jump in Tucson. We appreciate it.
Thank you once again.
Okay, great. You're listening to Jump in Tucson, which broadcasts from the Bustos Media Studios at KVOI 1030 AM radio. We appreciate you being here and listening to all the good things that are going on at the University of Arizona. We call it wonder because there's so many wonderful things happening, especially in astronomy. We wonder what's out there, and it's cool to see researchers telling us what is out there. You're listening to KVOI Radio, and we hope that you jump in Tucson.